Oliver Cromwell, he's called the Protector, and he's most linked with the English Civil War. Oliver Cromwell lived from 1599 to 1658, and there's no doubt that Cromwell was one of the greatest leaders ever to rule England. He wasn't a king, and yet in most books I've got of the kings of England, he has a chapter, because he ruled like a king of England, but he wasn't a king. Oliver Cromwell was a dedicated Puritan, deeply and fervently devoted to carrying out the will of God. Puritans were Calvinists, Puritans were Reformed, they were strongly believing in the sovereignty of God, but what made a Puritan different from the average Calvinist was the determination to change everything. A pilgrim was a Calvinist, but he just wanted to be left alone. He was a separatist who, they were the ones who went off to America, ended up in the Plymouth Rock, and started the colonies there, and they just want to be left alone. The pilgrims were separatists. The Puritans were reformers. They wanted to change everything, all the laws, the constitution, the whole country, the world. And so when you hear Puritan, you've got to understand Calvinist reformer. And Oliver Cromwell was relentless in battle, brilliant in organization. He had a genius for cavalry warfare. He had a psalm on his lips and a sword in his hand, and he led his Ironsides to victory after victory, first against the Royalists in England, then against the Catholics of Ireland, finally against the rebellious Scots. And considering how contentious Oliver Cromwell is, it's extraordinary that his is one of the only two statues in the grounds of the Palace of Westminster, the House of Parliament, both the House of Lords and the House of Commons, on the outside of the Parliament, but within the grounds. There's first, of course, the man who gave England its flag, King Richard the Lionheart. He's the one whose flag, the St. George's Cross, is the flag of England. His statue's there, which makes sense. And Oliver Cromwell's. Now, considering Oliver Cromwell's attributed with having chopped off the head of a king of England, it's quite extraordinary that his statue has pride of place that's even more prominent than that of Richard the Lionheart. So only two statues in the grounds of the English Parliament, which makes one wonder why. Oliver Cromwell pursued religious toleration, which helped to stabilize the fragile country after the execution of the king. His foreign policy in support of beleaguered Protestants in Europe and against the Muslim pirates in the Mediterranean was successful, and he restored the supremacy of the seas to England. When he came to power, English shore communities were in danger of Barbary pirates in North Africa raiding them and taking them off as slaves to North Africa. Not possible after Oliver Cromwell. He built up the English Navy that no pirates dared come anywhere near the shores. Cromwell came from a very distinguished family. He was one of the few people in England who could trace his family origins to the pre-Norman conquest times, in other words, to pre-1066. His family line, the Cromwell line, was a well-known, distinguished line, and here's, in fact, the church where he was christened, and you even see in the birth register his name at that church in Ely. His family were frequently active in the fight for liberty. Six of his cousins were imprisoned for refusing the forced loan, so-called forced loan, of 1627 of Charles I. When he was first elected as Member of Parliament in Huntingdon in 1628, nine of his cousins were Members of Parliament. 17 of his cousins and nine other relatives served at one time or another as members of the Long Parliament. It was just one Parliament. I mean, that's an extraordinary achievement. How many people had that many people involved in Parliament? He was born towards the end of Queen Elizabeth's reign. He would have been 4 years old when Elizabeth died. And he grieved England's decline from those golden years. His mother, his wife, and one of his daughters were all named Elizabeth, obviously. Very popular, high respect in his family for Queen Elizabeth. He frequently referred to Queen Elizabeth of famous memory. Now, it's interesting, because most Puritans during Queen Elizabeth's time were not satisfied with her. She wasn't Calvinist enough. But after her death, and they had to put up with James and Charles, Elizabeth began to look really good in comparison to the Puritans. Cromwell grew up in a country in crisis. England in the early 17th century was deeply troubled. King James had left his realm embroiled in a conflict in Europe against Spain that launched the 30 Years' War, which was a ruinous war which not only destroyed most of Germany, but it bankrupted the crown of England. And England was universally disgraced over its involvement in the 30 Years' War. James's heir, his son, King Charles I, married a French Catholic princess less than 3 months after he had inherited the throne. All of England had been against a Catholic marriage, but Charles evidenced contempt for the opinions of all. And you may wonder why England has laws today preventing any heir to the throne marrying a Catholic. Well, Charles is the main reason why they had to bring in laws like that in the English Bill of Rights of 1689. But Charles was such a catastrophe, he's such a disaster, and his marriage was unfortunately much at the heart of what led to England's meltdown and its civil war. He lied, he entered into war without parliamentary approval, Charles made secret concessions with Catholics, he undermined and interfered in the churches of England, he sent out his agents to collect forced loans, which is, forced loans, it's theft. He bypassed Parliament, he sent rich people to prison until they paid the ransom he demanded. He was a lawless king. You can see his earring as well in this picture. So England was under a tyrannical king. Land confiscations multiplied under Charles, and an increasing number of men were sent to prison for refusing to hand money over to the crown, which was nothing other than just ransom and theft. Arbitrary imprisonments without any recourse to the courts, depriving men of property without any semblance of the law, all of this jeopardized the rights of everyone in the realm. James summarily dissolved Parliament whenever it interfered with his will. He scorned a petition of rights, said Parliament had no rights, merely privileges granted by the Crown. The King didn't seem to consider himself to be bound by any promise. He didn't seem to himself to be bound to any law. But Parliament was going to challenge Charles. In March 1629, Parliament passed a bill that declared whoever brought in innovations in religion or introduced opinions disagreeing from those of the true and orthodox church, whoever voluntarily paid these duties was to be counted an enemy to the kingdom and a betrayer of its liberties. Immediately this motion was passed, the king dissolved Parliament and exacted a furious vengeance on Sir John Eliot, who had proposed the motion, and anyone else who had supported it. And if you want an example of the cruelty of King Charles I, here is it. Eliot and other members of Parliament were thrown to prison. Eliot remained in prison for the rest of his life, dying in the Tower of London in December 1632. Charles's pettiness was seen in how he even refused the widow of Eliot the right to take her husband's body to be buried at the Cornish home. That's the kind of man he was. And Charles appointed and dismissed judges at will. His appointed Archbishop Laud, the Archbishop of Canterbury, banned the publication of Calvinist sermons that had been collected since the time of Elizabeth and Edward VI. And what was hated the most was the Star Chamber. The cruelty of Archbishop Laud is seen in his Star Chamber. They treated Calvinist minister Alexander Lytton for writing a Puritan book by chaining him in solitary confinement until his hair fell out, until his skin fell off. He was tied to a stake and flogged until his back was raw. He was branded in the face, had his nose slit, his ears cut off. He's condemned to life imprisonment. This is by order of the Star Chamber under Archbishop of Canterbury, Laud. And that's just for being a writer of a Puritan book. That was his only crime. It was a war against Calvinism. From the moment that Laud was consecrated Archbishop of Canterbury in 1633, the Arminians assumed full control of the Church of England and declared war on Calvinism. Calvinist pastors were dismissed from their parishes, which meant they lost their homes, lost their income. And because the church was the Church of England, you couldn't go down the road and have another church or start another church. There was only one church allowed, and that was the Church of England. So being dismissed from your parish meant you were totally out of work. Calvinist writers and speakers were excommunicated, placed in the stocks, and had their ears cut off. The treatment that Calvinists received at the hands of the Arminian Star Chamber was remarkable because the Arminians accused Calvinists of being cruel in believing that God's salvation could be selective. So believing in limited atonement, total depravity of man, all of these basic principles of Calvinism was considered cruel. And so, to show that they weren't cruel, they cut off their ears and slit their noses and branded their faces. The Arminians also accused the Calvinists of being in favor of a theocracy, which means literally the rule of God, in which the church ruled the state, course, that's an ecclesiocracy, but still, they misunderstood what theocracy is. They claimed to be less ambitious, but in practice, the Armenians ruled the people through the state. So you've got the Calvinists who want God to rule the state, not the church, but God. Calvinist position is that the state's the minister of justice, and the church's the minister of grace. Both are under God. The church isn't to rule the state, and the state isn't to rule the church. They're separate. That's the Calvinist position. But the Armenians said they didn't want a theocracy, but they ended up ruling everything through the state. It's just another form of dictatorship. For example, Archbishop Lord had the author John Pym hauled before the Star Chamber for seditious libel, something he wrote. Pym was banned from further practice of law. He had his university degrees rescinded. How can you rescind a man's degrees? Was fined an impossible £5,000. That would have been in the region of £50 million by today's standards. He is pilloried, put in the stocks, had his ears cut off, and then sent to prison for life. All this because of one book he had written. This is the kind of vindictiveness under Charles and Archbishop Laud. Charles is famous for having ruled without Parliament. All of these abuses took place during the 11 years that Charles ruled England without Parliament. And these 11 years were the longest years in English history without Parliament at all. He just suspended Parliament for 11 years. Now, of course, you remember that under James, his father, Scotland and England had united in the United Kingdom. Well, at this point, the Scottish section of the United Kingdom had enough. Because although this is the House of Stuart, which is meant to be Scottish, they were so intolerant of Presbyterianism and so much trying to push the Armenian version of the Church of England upon them that the Scots rebelled. And when the Scottish rebelled against the imposition of what they saw as Roman Catholic superstition and ritual in their churches, you might recall a famous scene which it all started, where the Archbishop appointed a bishop in Edinburgh who started to read the High Church prayer book, which was very Roman Catholic, and this woman took her three-stool chair and she threw the chair against the bishop's head literally hit him in the head. This started a general uprising that chased the bishops out of Scotland. That was the beginning of the rebellion of the Scots. Some woman with her milking stool that she took to church. Remember, there were no pews in church at that time. You'd stand in church, you'd bring your own little stool. So that was the beginning of the rebellion. Now, Charles was forced to recall Parliament to raise new taxes on the army because he didn't have enough money. He was bankrupt. And this is the beginning of the short Parliament. You'll hear about the short Parliament, the long Parliament, or the bare bones Parliament. Well, this is the short Parliament. The short Parliament was summoned on 13th of April, 1640. Instead of providing Charles with the money and the men that he needed to fight the Scots, they immediately start talking about the crimes of Charles's government, the atrocities of Archbishop Laud, the illegal taxation of the people, the forced loans, the excesses of the High Commission, the terrors of the Star Chamber, all that they'd been waiting to talk about for 11 years, but their first opportunity. This Parliament lasted only 23 days. That's got to be a world record for the shortest Parliament in record. The King dissolves at 5th of May. And this is the remonstrance of the people of England, many thousands of citizens and freeborn people of England, to the House of Commons, which was cataloguing the horrors of what the people had to endure under Charles's dictatorship. And so you've got a kingdom in crisis. Forget the Scots. The English are ready to rebel as well. A whole series of crisis situations compelled Charles to call for a new Parliament. Muslim pirates were raiding the Irish and Cornish coasts, carrying Christians off into Islamic slavery, and the English navy was powerless to stop them. English settlers were being slaughtered by the Catholics in Ireland. A Scottish army had seized northern England, and there was a general belief that a Catholic conspiracy was at work to destroy English liberties and install an absolutist Catholic monarchy, which they almost had anyway. And this is where the Long Parliament comes in, and they seized the initiative. For 11 years, newspapers had been banned. The secret circulation of pamphlets were all that kept the people informed. King Charles was being outmaneuvered and cornered. But this was his main man, his right-hand man, and this man is the Earl of Strafford. He is the King's dictator of Ireland. And so the Long Parliament worked out the first person to get rid of was Strafford. And they saw him as a secret papist plotting to bring his Catholic army from Ireland to alter the laws and the religion of England, because he was doing nothing to protect the Protestants who were being massacred and their farms stolen in Ireland, and they saw him as a secret papist. So here, Parliament calls on Strafford, and Strafford's having to hand over his sword before trial before the House of Commons. You can see the table with the actual authority of Parliament on top of it. And here is the famous execution of the Earl of Strafford. They tried him for treason, and they had him executed on in sight of the Tower, on Tower Hill. So this is a record turnout for the Earl of Strafford's execution. People were absolutely delighted to get rid of this lackey of the king, this dictator of Ireland, who they said was plotting to be able to seize the people in Parliament and have them imprisoned. The House of Commons also charged that the Arminian changes in the canons of the Church of England were illegal. And so they impeached Archbishop Laud, the Archbishop of Canterbury, of popery and treason. He ended up in the same Tower of London to which he had consigned so many others. And he ended up being executed too, by order of Parliament. That's a case of man reaping what he's sown. Censorship was abolished. Pamphlets on religion and government couldn't be produced fast enough. The demand was so great, London became a fountain of Puritan publications dealing with God, government, faith and morals. And there's a lot of books we've got around us here which are a result of that time. There was unprecedented freedom for publication of Puritan materials. The king's government collapsed. His ministers fled the country. They could see the way things were going. Systematically, Parliament dismantled the instruments by which the king had oppressed the nation. No taxes could be levied without parliamentary consent. The Star Chamber, abolished. Its tortures, abolished. Privy Council, deprived of its powers. The Court of the High Commission, abolished. They left the king financially dependent on Parliament, and Parliament took control of the militia. Oliver Cromwell played an increasingly pivotal role in Parliament. The Long Parliament, which began its sitting on the 3rd of November 1640, was the fifth Parliament of Charles's reign. Cromwell had been in two previous Parliaments, which had been summarily dissolved by King Charles. Now, he was a squire, which gave him the position of a magistrate in his area, and so he was a responsible and respected leader in his community, which is the County of Cambridge. He's the Puritan politician. I've got this book, To Honour God, which is just from the writings of Oliver Cromwell, his personal piety, and you can see a devout love for God, a real hatred of his own sins, a humility, a repentance, a desire to crucify the flesh and to be filled with the Spirit. This man was a very, very spiritual man. I've also got two editions, which are thick volumes on my shelf, of a 19th century publication with all of Cromwell's published speeches and letters. And if there ever was a Puritan politician and soldier, this was it. Oliver Cromwell is described as having penetrating eyes of steely blue, being profoundly religious, very well read, eloquent, full of fervour, and with an iron conviction which his character turned to steel. You could not budge him if he was convinced this was right. He was a graduate of Cambridge University. He was a descendant of Henry VIII's Chancellor Thomas Cromwell and a dedicated Puritan. Thomas Cromwell, you'll recall, is the Chancellor under Henry VIII, who for 11 years masterminded under a Catholic monarch a Protestant Reformation. So he's a really, he lost his head for it, but he's the one who dismantled the monasteries. He's the one who published the Bible. The Coverdale Bible was produced under him. The Great Bible was produced under him. He's the one who managed to convince the king to have published the very Bible which Tyndale had just been executed for. And so Thomas Cromwell was a courageous and conniving and incredibly wise but principled chancellor, that he had been able to do this. And of course he knew he was playing with his head, and he lost it, as so many other people who worked for Henry VIII did. He was playing a dangerous game, because Henry VIII was never Protestant. Henry VIII just wanted to be free of the conniving machinations of Rome, of a pope. He still had Catholic doctrine, but somehow or another, Thomas Cromwell launched a reformation under Henry VIII without Henry VIII ever approving of it. So that was one of his ancestors. In 1620, Oliver had married Elizabeth Bourchier, and Cromwell proved himself an affectionate husband with a deep love towards his many children. Here you can see a home scene where none other than John Milton is playing the piano for family devotions. When he was 28, Cromwell was elected to Parliament as a member for Huntingdon, and this Parliament lasted less than 5 months before the King dissolved it, so he knew all about the King's capriciousness. It was 11 years before the short Parliament was summoned, and by the time the long Parliament was summoned, on the 3rd of November 1640, Oliver Cromwell was nearly 42 years old. Up to this point, incredibly, he had no military experience, but that was about to change. War came to England, and nobody could have anticipated the key role that Oliver Cromwell would have played. As war became inevitable, it seemed that the King's forces had the great advantage. They had trained and experienced cavalry. The Royalist officers were experienced at fencing and riding. Noblemen's sons were brought up fencing and riding. And what did the common people, middle class and the shopkeepers have? They didn't have that kind of experience. There was going to be no contest in this war, you would have thought. Leading the King's cavalry was his cousin Prince Rupert of the Rhine, who was very experienced in the 30 Years' War. He had been fighting in the Dutch and German wars, the 30 Years' War, and he brought 100 professional officers, all experienced in the 30 Years' War, into the fray. And how could the parliamentary forces compare with that? They had no experience on their side. The first battle of the war was the Battle of Edge Hill. 23 October 1642, the King's forces, led by Prince Rupert, descended upon the parliamentary infantry so effectively it was almost a massacre. It was a very quick turnaround, and after thundering through Essex's men, the cavalry stopped to plunder baggage, and if they hadn't, that would have been the end of the parliamentary forces. Fortunately, their men got too excited about the plunder, forgot about consolidating the victory until the parliamentary forces could get away. This gave Captain Cromwell the opportunity to counterattack with his cavalry. He halted the Royalist effort to march in London. It was basically a Royalist victory, but limited. Cromwell observed to his cousin, John Hampton, that they would never be able to beat these gentlemen's sons schooled in sword fighting and horse riding with old, decaying serving men. Oliver Cromwell said he was going to set out to find honest men who feared God and not the enemy, men who were filled with the Holy Spirit. And that's where he began selecting and training a special force. This is the beginning of a professional military army, which England did not have until that time. Cromwell's initiative earned him a promotion to colonel. And Richard Baxter noted that Oliver Cromwell had a special care to get only religious men into his troops, because these were the sorts of men he esteemed and he loved. And from this happy choice flowed the avoidance of those disorders, mutinies, plunderings, grievances of the country, which debased men and armies are commonly guilty of. Nobody had to fear when Cromwell's army passed through. They stole nothing. Everyone's daughters were safe. There was no damage to private property. They were restrained, they were disciplined, there was psalm singing. And by May 1643, Cromwell had selected and trained 2,000 brave, disciplined, and dedicated men. And they played the key role in all the battles that were to follow. In May 1643, Cromwell, heavily outnumbered, attacked a Royalist force at Belton and killed over 100 at the cost of only 2 men. Cromwell's men quickly earned a reputation for being religious, obedient, fearless, and disciplined. In October 1643, Cromwell won a victory at Winsby. Prince Rupert led the King's forces to massacre the Calvinists of Bolton at Clovington, but Cromwell's Ironsides were victorious at the Battle of Gainsborough on 28th of July 1643. What marks Cromwell from all of his contemporaries is his passion for religious freedom. Cromwell rose in Parliament in December 1644 to propose a self-denying ordinance in which all members should resign their military commands. If you're in Parliament, you resign your military commands. If you're in the army, you resign your parliamentary position. You can't be in both, one or the other. And then he argued for religious freedom. Presbyterians, independents, all here had the same spirit of faith and prayer. They agree here They know no names of difference. Pity it should be otherwise anywhere. All that believe have the real unity, which is most glorious, because inward and spiritual. As for being united in forms, commonly called uniformity, every Christian will, for peace sake, study and do as far as conscience will permit. And from brethren and things of the mind, we look for no compulsion but that of light and reason. This is the first time anyone was advocating religious freedom. Oliver Cromwell's statue is at the Reformation Wall in Geneva, one of only 10 people depicted on the wall in main statue, along with Calvin, Farrell, Knox and Beza, and Prince William the Silent. Remarkable. He is there because of his strong stand for Calvinism, for the Reformation, and for religious freedom. We look for no compulsion but that of light and reason. Up till then, the idea was you had to have a state church. Some wanted a state Presbyterian church. Others wanted a state ecclesiastical church, which is more Episcopalian. But he wanted independent churches. You can have high church, low church, doesn't matter. Let every congregation decide. He was for congregational self-government, not for state or pressure and compulsion. But now a new threat arose, not from the king, from Parliament. He was horrified to see that Parliament was seeking to impose Presbyterianism on the nation. Baptists, Congregationalists, Anglicans and other believers had fought on the field of battle for religious freedom against Catholicism and against episcopal tyranny such as that represented by Archbishop Laud. Were they now going to replace that with Presbyterian tyranny? As he said, a Presbyterian Pope is as obnoxious as a Romanist one. Cromwell demanded the restructuring of the army. He castigated those sections of the army which were profaneness and impiety, and the absence of all religion, the drinking and gambling and all manner of license and laziness. This had led to the poor performance and defeat. And, of course, there were those. He argued for a new model army, and he was appointed second in command under the parliamentary forces which were led by Lord Fairfax. Now, Fairfax turned out to be a traitor in time, but at this stage, Lord Fairfax was technically in charge, whereas Cromwell was only second command. But most people would have missed that because Cromwell won all the victories and Fairfax actually didn't really seem to make much of a showing. He was more of the nominal head, but the one who was making it happen was Cromwell. Out of the total parliamentary force of over 88,000, Cromwell selected and trained a quarter, 22,000, as a new model army. They're the ones who did all the work. And now they started to win victories. At Marsden Moor, one of the greatest cavalry victories ever, 2nd of July 1644, Oliver Cromwell led his cavalry to victory over the Royalists in a most decisive battle. By now Cromwell was a Lieutenant General. I mean, in 2 years he's gone from Captain to Lieutenant General. And his disciplined, Bible-reading, psalm-singing troops won the day. His new model army won a most decisive battle also at Naseby, 14 June 1645, which is very close to Lutterworth, where the Morning Star of the Reformation, Professor John Wycliffe, translated the Bible into English and sent out the Lollards. Well, the victory at Naseby in 1645 ended the First Civil War. You may wonder how many civil wars were there? Actually, three. This is the first one, over. But now he returns home to find Presbyterian tyranny. Parliament established the Church of England as a Presbyterian church with orders to persecute Baptist, Congregationalists and other nonconformists who were to be imprisoned for life and on some occasions to be put to death for preaching without a Presbyterian license. No laymen were allowed to preach or expound the scriptures. Only those duly ordained in a Presbyterian church were the only people allowed to preach, witness, evangelize at all. And that's actually on the statute books, and you can go and look in the Hansard, and unbelievable, they actually passed that piece of legislation 1645, where they're out of their minds. So, Oliver Cromwell was horrified. This had not been what his army was fighting for. He argued most passionately for religious freedom, for liberty of conscience. The army did not want to see an Arminian absolutism replaced with a Presbyterian version. The independence, which is effectively what Oliver Cromwell was. He was Church of England. Everyone was Church of England. But he was of the Congregationalist bent, wanting congregational self-government. Nobody wanted a national church anymore amongst the independents. They wanted all varieties of Protestant faith to be free of state interference and limitations. When the Parliament sought to disband the New Model Army, which was overwhelmingly composed of Congregationalists, Baptists and other independents, the Army Council sent a message to Parliament demanding liberty of conscience for all its members. Cromwell wrote, "He that ventures his life for the liberty of his country, I wish he trust God for the liberty of his conscience and you for the liberty he fights for." That was a plain threat. We're the ones who fought for religious freedom. You have no right to take it from us. And he wanted checks and balances. Because people are depraved. You can't trust people. It doesn't matter even if they are meant to be Protestant Christians. You can't trust anyone with unlimited power. The Army Council proposed a Council of State, free elections, an enlarged franchise, which was quite limited to only landowners at that stage, the right to dissent with both King and the Lords, no bishops, no compulsory orders of service, no compulsory obedience to Presbyterianism, and although one of the King's advisers observed, "Never was a crown so nearly lost, so cheaply recovered," the King contemptuously dismissed these and all other proposals for settlement. He could have saved his head and his kingdom if he had just accepted. But Charles was intransigent. Cromwell then became the power broker between the army, Parliament, and the captive Charles in an attempt to restore a constitutional base for Parliament. If it was left to Parliament, where the Presbyterians predominated, they would have cheerfully locked up Baptists and executed Quakers and congregations. If it was up to the King, they would have been back to the Star Chamber. So he was trying to use the army as a power broker between to get settlement that would not install either Arminian tyranny, Papist tyranny, or Presbyterian tyranny. But dealing with a slippery and inflexible Stuart monarch exhausted Cromwell's patience. And a second civil war broke out. You don't normally get the story of this when it comes to the films. They just limit to one and it gets too complicated. But there was a second civil war. In 1647, Charles escaped. And he sought to restart the war, this time with the Scottish Presbyterians in support. The first war started because he's trying to get money from Parliament to attack the Scots. Now he's getting the Scots' support to attack Parliament. This is 1984 George Orwell type of scene. You know, your enemy of yesterday is now your ally, and your ally of yesterday is now your enemy. Defeating the Royalist Welsh and Scottish rebels in 1648, Cromwell supported a trial for treason of the King, which ended in the execution of Charles, 30th of January, 1649. On the 17th of August, 1648, Cromwell achieved a tremendous victory at Preston. He quickly broke up the Royalist army and seized 10,000 prisoners. As on any other occasion Cromwell won a victory, he was careful, very careful, to give all the glory to God. He wrote, "It pleased God to enable us to give them a defeat." He wasn't a boastful man. On the 6th of August, 1647, the army, 18,000 strong, with the King in the midst, entered London. Despite the illusions of the Presbyterians in Parliament, the army knew it and it alone had defeated the King. The army included officers and men who had previously been excluded from the religious and political consensus, and they were determined not to have Parliament send them back to the pattern of the past that they had so successfully fought against. And what were they fighting for? And lots of independent congregations and a qualified franchise. Cromwell emerged as the leader of the independents, favouring freedom of religion for all Protestants. Nobody was talking about freedom of religion for Catholics. Catholics didn't give religious freedom to Protestants anywhere. They weren't interested in religious freedom for the Catholics at all. They just wanted freedom for Protestants. John Milton, who was his secretary, Henry Ireton, who was his son-in-law, and Oliver Cromwell argued for rule by the virtuous, selected by men of standing. So they wanted a qualified franchise. They're rejecting the universal franchise proposed by the Levellers, which is the most radical section at that stage. Levellers didn't want any nobility, any bishops, any clergy. They just wanted everything level. That was revolutionary. They weren't after that. And Cromwell said, "A man with no more fixed property than what he may carry about with him, one who is here today and gone tomorrow, would be enabled by numbers to enact confiscatory laws from those people of property who had commitment to the society, who were the ones who should actually have the vote. So they advocated a qualified franchise based upon ownership of property. Didn't matter how big your property size or how small, you should be allowed to vote if you own property. If you didn't own property, you shouldn't have the vote, because it meant you weren't committed. That's the basis they decide to use. At this stage, they're dealing with treachery and duplicity. There's not just two faces to Charles, there were three. While the Parliament was arguing over the form of their future faith and freedoms, King Charles was negotiating with the Scots, promising to accept and impose Presbyterianism over England, suppressing all nonconformists. This while he's also negotiating with the Pope and the Irish in order to guarantee imposition of Catholicism on the land in exchange for their army. The Scots had launched the war against Charles in the first place, now decided it was God's will that Presbyterianism should be enforced over England to restoring Charles to the throne. So there's a lot of inconsistency and hypocrisy going on here. On the 3rd of May 1648, the Scots issued a manifesto calling on all England to accept their covenant and to suppress all religious dissent from Presbyterianism. Everybody in England had to be a Presbyterian. Now, we know that just about everyone in Scotland was Presbyterian. A few of the English were. Now, they also demanded that the new model army be disbanded. Now, considering the Scots were the ones who started the war a few times over, the idea of disbanding the new model army didn't seem very intelligent. The Royalist Cavaliers, both from within and outside of England, hurried to join the Scots in this new conflict against parliamentary forces. So, the Royalists had been fighting the Presbyterians just a few years before, now suddenly they're on their side. And the Second Civil War saw the Presbyterians allied with the Armenians against the independents and the new model army. How these two theological opposites expected to settle their differences with one another if they ever defeated the new model army was a question nobody dared to even ask, let alone attempt to answer at that time. There's no way it could have worked. It was ridiculous. But that's what happened. You had these theological opposites working together just because they hated the Calvinists, the Puritans. Cromwell led part of the army to Wales, where they laid siege to Pembroke Castle. And this nearly impregnable stronghold took an agonizing 6 weeks to subdue. He didn't have that much time to spare. Cromwell then had to force march his army across the country to intersect the invading Scottish army before it got too far south. In a ferocious 3-day battle, he defeated the Scots. Now the army was outraged that the duplicity and treachery of the king had led to a new war, even against their previous allies, the Scots, who they had not been willing to fight against. The army demanded that this man of blood be tried for treason. And there was a real, true unity of believers at this time. Cromwell wrote to his cousin Robin Hammond, who was guarding the king on the Isle of Wight, "I profess to thee a desire from my heart. I've prayed for it. I've waited for the day to see the union and right understanding between the godly people, Scots, English, Jews, Gentiles, Presbyterians, Independents, Baptists, and all." He wanted a real, true spiritual unity, not a formal, outward organization, but a genuine spiritual unity. And to do this, they believed they had to get rid of this king, put him on trial. He was the problem. 135 men were nominated to the High Court of Justice, and the trial of the king began on the 8th of January, held in the ancient Westminster Palace, which had originally been built in the time of Norman King William Rufus. In it, Sir Thomas More had been tried, Guy Fawkes had been tried, Earl of Stafford had been tried. This is a place of high drama. And you may recall, on his recent visit to England, Pope Benedict had a reception in this very hall, which outraged a lot of Protestants, because no Catholic should be allowed to go there except on trial. And they were convicting Charles of treason. The indictment against the king read that he had, by wicked design, erected and upheld in himself an unlimited and tyrannical power to overthrow the rights and the liberties of the people. That he had traitorously and maliciously levied war against the present Parliament and against the people. That he was a tyrant, a traitor, a murderer, a public and implacable enemy to the Commonwealth of England. And this is showing the crest of English Parliament, the mace of Parliament, and the sword on the table. King Charles placed here, the people gathered, that's the High Court, mostly of parliamentarians, who were sitting in judgment of him. Evidence was brought forward of the illegal taxes, the arbitrary imprisonments, the mutilations, the tortures, the executions of people whose only crime had been to disagree with the king on matters of faith and ethics. That had trampled upon the common law of England and the chartered rights guaranteed by the Magna Carta, the Great Charter of 1215, which all English monarchs must swear to uphold, and he had trampled upon it. The prosecutor argued that there is a contract and a bargain made between the king and his people. A bond of protection is due from the sovereign. Just as we must be loyal to the king must, we owe him allegiance, he owes us protection. And the bond of subjection that is due from the subject, if this bond is ever broken, farewell sovereignty. If the king will not protect the subjects, he has no right to be ruler. The authority of a ruler is valid only so long as he can provide protection in return. But the king had made war against his own subjects. Therefore, he is a traitor. Despite Charles' attempts to disrupt and derail the proceedings, the death warrant was signed by 59 of the commissioners. There's the death warrant up top left with the seals of different nobles or House of Lords and the different squires and magistrates who had their own seals. And here the king is being walked to the block where they're outside in Whitehall. They erected a scaffolding where they had the king executed in view of a large number of people. Cromwell described the execution of Charles on the 30th of January 1649 as a cruel necessity. He took no delight in it, but as he said, we didn't assassinate. This was done in the face of God and before all men. That was not the end of the threat, because Charles I had his son, who became Charles II. And Charles II was in exile in France. When Charles II promised that he would impose Presbyterianism upon the realm, a totally hypocritical promise, because he never meant it, and he certainly didn't. He was no more Presbyterian than anyone, but he promised that the Scottish Presbyterians mobilized to fight their Protestant brethren in England on the basis of this obviously dishonest promise from this utterly untrustworthy man. And a Catholic uprising in Ireland also threatened the new republic. So the Council of State appointed Oliver Cromwell as Lord General of the new army to deal with the Catholic threat in Ireland. Now note, Cromwell's not ruling England. Cromwell's not running Parliament, although he did force Parliament to adhere to the will of the army on a few things, such as not executing Baptists and Congregationalists. But he's not even the head of the army. He's only second commander of the army at this stage. He's in charge of an army just to deal with the Catholic threat, though, in Ireland. Knowing that he still had to deal with the Scottish threat, Cromwell had to determine to subdue the Irish as quickly and as finally as possible. They'd already fought two civil wars. Now they're going into the third. And his first action on reaching Ireland was to forbid any plunder or pillage. Two men were hanged for disobeying that, so he would not tolerate any plunder, obviously. And here you can see his movement. He raced from one side to the other in Ireland, fighting battles all the way along and taking any of the castles that he could. He wanted to be sure he didn't have to come back to Ireland again. Remember, Ireland had been absolutely unstable part of the realm for generations, killing Protestants for a long time. So there was a determination to deal with the Catholic threat decisively. At Drogheda, Cromwell's forces crushed the Catholic stronghold in a ferocious battle. He moved on to Wexford, long a thorn in the side of English traders and a sense of piracy against their vessels. As the town refused to surrender, after an intense 8-day siege, it was put to the sword. Cromwell prayed that this bitterness will save much blood through the goodness of God. Now these two names, Drogheda and Wexford, are listed by enemies of Cromwell as examples of what a horrible, evil man he was and what brutal soldiers the New Model Army were, because they basically massacred all the Catholic men-at-arms, all the defenders in these towns. That was not unusual for the time. The rules of war at that time was if you surrendered, everyone would be spared. If you forced them to storm the fixed position and you lost, then all the defenders would be killed. That was standard warfare at the time, because you lost a lot of men storming a defended position. A siege is long-winded, it takes a lot of time, but if you've got to take the city, if any time in the siege they give up, quarter was to be given, no one was to be harmed. But if you had to take it by storm, which always favoured the defender had all the advantages in that situation with the weapons at that time, then the rules of war at that time was, if we've got to come in and storm you, then no defender will be spared. That was standard military practice. Everybody did it at that stage. And to single out Cromwell's forces as having done something particularly unusual is unfair. That's what every army did on all sides at that stage. And it was hard, but remember, Ireland was a thorn in their flesh. He's got to still go and fight the Scots. He can't have to drag his army back across to Ireland again. He wanted to put this once and for all. And so in dealing with Drogheda and Wexford so harshly, that was the end of the war. There was no more fights needed. These two major strongholds of resistance in Ireland, after being subdued, the war was over, the other places surrendered, actually lives were saved. Interestingly enough, I know people in Ireland from those towns who have written biographies on Cromwell, and the title of one of the books is Honourable Enemy. And from a Catholic, descended from people from Drogheda, and he shows that, in fact, the propaganda against Cromwell is completely unfair, because none of his men raped, looted, stole, abused people. They were well-disciplined, and in fact, they were a lot more pleasant than the way many of the Catholic armies in Ireland had treated their own people before that. So this propaganda against him, I think, to a large extent, is motivated by the fact that he's Protestant, he's Puritan, he's Calvinist, he's Reformed, he's hard against the Catholics. And it's not because his army was in any way harsher than any other army. In fact, quite the contrary. But that's the nature of propaganda. Discredit your enemies. Now, after subduing all the strongholds in Ireland, Cromwell learned that Charles II had landed in Scotland. He left his son-in-law, Henry Ireton, to complete the mopping up operations in Ireland, and he returned to England. And now he's got to march his army all the way up to Scotland. This is very hard. Remember, this is before trains or any kind of motorized transport. You had to walk or ride on horseback everywhere. This is hard slog. Support, infrastructure, quartermaster, you can just imagine. Very hard to even get food for your men. Young Charles II had signed the Scots National Covenant and Solemn League and Covenant, swearing to maintain Presbyterianism in his household and all his dominions. It's a total blatant hypocritical lie. This man never meant to, and he certainly never did it. Charles II was crowned King of Scotland at Scone. And Lord Fairfax, the supreme commander of the parliamentary forces, refused to lead an English army into Scotland because he was a Presbyterian. So he showed himself to be a traitor. He has never committed to the English cause at all. So Fairfax was relieved of command, and one wonders why he ever had it in the first place. And Oliver Cromwell was appointed supreme commander of the parliamentary forces. Only now is Cromwell commander of the whole army. Up till then, he'd only been second commander. Again, most history books would forget that. And Cromwell didn't just defeat the Scots this time, he conquered Scotland, because they never wanted to have to do this again. With his usual fearful efficiency, Oliver Cromwell led his 16,000 well-equipped, well-experienced, determined troops into Scotland. And despite being heavily outnumbered, trapped by superior forces, Cromwell decisively defeated the Scottish army at Dunbar on the 3rd of September 1650. He seized 10,000 prisoners and soon occupied Edinburgh and Leith. At this point, you have a most interesting exercise in them trying to reason with Scottish Presbyterians. Our brethren of Scotland, are we to be dealt with as enemies because we do not agree with you on all points? Are you sure that your league with wicked and carnal men is a covenant of God? I pray you. Read Isaiah 28. Here they were allied effectively with papists. And how could they justify this? I beseech you in the mercies of Christ, think it possible that you may be mistaken. Are you troubled that Christ has preached? Is preaching so inclusive in your function? That they want to execute Baptists and Congregationalists for preaching? More than once, you know, first time you get locked up for life, second time you get executed. You know, really? Do you Do you want to be upset because somebody else is preaching Christ in a different way from you? And his famous statement, I beseech you in the mercy of Christ, think it possible you may be mistaken. Well, apparently the Presbyterians couldn't consider possible that they could be mistaken because they knew. They were somehow all-knowing, omniscient. Cromwell argued and reasoned for liberty of conscience and for religious toleration. Now, his persuasions were somewhat successful as numerous covenanters chose neutrality in the war thereafter. I suppose that's about the best you could get, neutrality. The English Civil War shows the victory of the independents. On the 3rd of November 1651, a year after the Battle of Dunbar, Cromwell's forces decisively defeated another Scottish army at Worcester. Charles II's massive army of 30,000 were put to flight and scattered, very decisively. It was remarkable that the Presbyterians, the Armenian Episcopals, the Catholics could have cooperated together to fight the Protestant Parliament of England. Each of these three groups believed in the tradition of a single faith in a single land, not tolerating dissent, and they were willing to cooperate with their most determined enemies in order to crush the independent Calvinists, the Baptists, and the Congregationalists of Parliament. This reminds one of the crucifixion of Christ, how the Romans, the Herodians, the Sadducees, and the Pharisees could cooperate together to crucify Christ. They had nothing in common except the hatred for Christ. And it's something about that, that people who've got nothing in common will often work together because they just hate true Christianity. Just think how, for example, the feminists, the homosexuals, and the Muslims will work together. Bizarre, they've got nothing in common. And yet, liberals in America who totally pro the radical feminist and radical homosexual agenda, they will rather have the Muslims take over, even though it'll destroy them. Because at least the enemies are those cursed Christians. It's sometimes the hatred for Christ brings a unity. But the question is, why can't Christians unite together? Our enemies will unite against us. But Christians often have a problem uniting with people just slightly different from themselves. Cromwell's triumph is quite evident. By the way, he didn't put up this statue. This statue was put up in the days of Queen Victoria. This wasn't put up in his lifetime. Imagine that. A few centuries later, royalists would put up this statue to somebody who is the most famous figure linked to the execution of the king in parliamentary grounds. And I've been told by Dr. Ian Paisley that there have been several attempts while he's been parliament to have that statue removed, but the bulk of parliament have refused to allow anyone to touch it because, see, we would not be here if it hadn't been for him. Parliament can thank Oliver Cromwell and his independence for the fact that we even have a parliament that is the highest law in the land. The victory of Worcester was to be Oliver Cromwell's last battle. He was now 52 years old. In campaign after campaign, Oliver Cromwell had triumphed often over vastly superior forces numerically. Cromwell's tactics had proved themselves again and again, his aggressive, disciplined cavalry tactics, seizing the initiative. He was welcomed back to London in triumph in September 1651. He was now at the height of his power and the height of his prestige. As Captain General of the Army, as a member of the Council of State, Oliver Cromwell's position in England was unassailable. The English royalists had been bled white, decisively defeated time and again. There couldn't be another threat. Charles I had been executed. Charles II had fled to France. The Second Civil War had ended. England was firmly under control of parliamentary forces. Ireland was subdued. Scotland had been conquered. The three kingdoms of England, Ireland, and Scotland were united under parliamentary government in London. But there's still enough problems within Parliament itself. You didn't need problems outside. There's enough problems there. The situation that confronted Oliver Cromwell upon his return to London was most disturbing. In his absence, England had declared war on Protestant Holland. This was the first war in English history that was fought primarily for economic reasons. Cromwell was horrified that the English Republic would have waged war against the Protestant Dutch. To him, our allegiance and our unity with fellow Protestants should be our ruling principle in all foreign affairs. He depreciated the Licensing Acts, the Treason Acts, all of which overrode customary liberties. The war with Holland was resented by the New Model Army. The soldiers wanted to know when would they see the reforms for which they had fought. When Parliament refused to renew the Commission for the Propagation of the Gospel in Wales, which was the army's favourite instrument for evangelising a politically unstable country, which was mostly Catholic. This created a storm. Oliver Cromwell was outraged. This, we apprehended, would have been throwing away the liberties of the nation into the hands of those who never fought for it. You parliamentarians weren't fighting for our freedoms, and you wanted to take away our freedoms? And it was this parliamentary intolerance which led to the end of the Long Parliament. The parliamentary intolerance and interference in the religious liberty of the independents increased. So Oliver Cromwell gathered some soldiers and, accompanied by Major General Thomas Harrison, he entered Parliament, sat down and listened to the discussions. At length he rose and calmly began to speak of his concern that Parliament had become a self-perpetuating oligarchy, ruled by an elite, unfit to govern England. He condemned the members of Parliament as drunkards and whoremasters. And the speech went far south after that. I mean, he started very calmly and he ended up out with you. You're no Parliament, I'll say. You're no Parliament. I'll put an end to your sittings. He called to Harrison and said, call him in. And the soldiers marched in and Cromwell told them to clear the room. The members left, some of the protest. And this ended the Long Parliament. The Parliament that had dethroned the King, abolished the House of Lords, created a new government, won a revolution, only itself to be abolished. And now there was to be a new Parliament. And I might add, I've seen even friends of mine write wrong accusations against Cromwell, saying Oliver Cromwell abolished Christmas. I read that just recently. Oliver Cromwell never abolished Christmas. The Presbyterian Parliament abolished Christmas while he was out fighting across the border in Ireland and Scotland. He, when he got power, he legalized Christmas. There was all sorts of funny things that the Presbyterian Parliament did, but Cromwell wasn't running Parliament at that stage. He wasn't even a member of Parliament at that stage because of the self-denying ordinance. Cromwell called for a new Parliament of just 140 members. Some of these were chosen by churches, others by various generals, five were from Scotland, six from Ireland, but London Puritans obviously predominated because closer for travel. In short order, this Parliament reviewed the judicial system, voted to abolish the Court of Chancery. Tenants were provided protection against arbitrary expulsion. For the first time in English history, marriages were made possible by civil ceremony, that if for conscience reason you didn't want a Church of England wedding, you could have any kind of wedding. Their proposals not to execute pickpockets and horse thieves for first offences shocked the lawyers. That was the law up till that stage. They said, this isn't right. These people should be given a chance for restitution, not execute them on a first offence. Many of these reforms were constructive, but they alienated the population by seeking to abolish tithes. Can you believe it? Your compulsory tithes that were taken into the church, they abolished, and many people horrified at that. Concerned that Parliament was seeking to undermine the church and secure ownership of property, the army grew impatient and persuaded the members to voluntarily dissolve. I wonder how they persuaded them. And they came up with a new constitution. A committee produced a constitution titled the Instrument of Government. On the 16th of December 1653, Oliver Cromwell was proclaimed Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of England, Scotland and Ireland. Again, I've heard people say, how could Cromwell declare war in Holland? Cromwell never declared war in Holland. He's the one who ended the war with Holland. He only officially became the ruler of Parliament and of England in 1653. And all those things took place before he had that position. He was Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of England, Scotland and Ireland. This was an elective position, not for life, not hereditary, so he wasn't actually a dictator, although some books call him that. The Lord Protector was to be chief executive, assisted by a council of 15 members, 8 of which would be civilians, 7 army officers. Parliament was to retain the power alone to levy taxes. He couldn't tax. Grants applied to the government, nor could the Protector dissolve Parliament while it was in session. And he always stood for religious freedom. You should remember that John Bunyan, who wrote the famous books, both Pilgrim's Progress and Holy War, was one of the soldiers of Oliver Cromwell. Oliver Cromwell believed in an established, non-Episcopal, evangelical church with full toleration of dissent and separate congregations. In other words, he wanted a congregational system that could be anything. You could have as high church, low church. That wasn't a problem. It should be decided by the local congregation. His position was fully supported by the Baptists, the Congregationalists, and other independents. And the new government was silent on rites, ceremonies, and sacraments. You could have all the ceremony you want, or none if you want, but that's not the point. How you administer the Lord's Supper, baptism, that's up to each congregation. Church government was to be congregational, allowing for a Presbyterian, Independent, Baptist, Episcopalian government of any congregation. Any form of Protestant worship was permitted. That was Cromwell's ideal. Now, there have always been accusations that under Cromwell and the Puritans, the arts were suppressed, and they banned and closed down the theatres, and that's just not true. Writers found the protectorate under Oliver Cromwell far more lenient than all his bureaucratic predecessors. Literature flourished. The Calvinist love of poetry appeared everywhere. Christmas again became festive. Musical instruments, entertainment, the theatre, which had been prohibited under the Presbyterian Parliament, now were encouraged under the Puritan protectorate. So there's a lot of things blamed on Cromwell, which actually were part of the Presbyterian Parliament, not part of his protectorate. The first full-length, five-act English opera, The Siege of Rhodes, the Island of Rhodes, the siege, of course, was taking place under the Muslims a century before. That premiered in 1656 under the Protector. Women were again allowed to wear makeup, which had been banned by Parliament. Even play writings, which satirized the government, was allowed. You could ridicule and criticize the government. That wasn't a problem. You didn't get arrested for that. And it was during the Commonwealth that the violin became popular and that solo singing began to be enjoyed. So to say that the arts were suppressed isn't true. There's quite a lot of new developments in arts under his short five-year protectorate. It's his foreign policy that's the most impressive. In terms of foreign policy, Oliver Cromwell promptly made peace with Holland. The British Navy crossed the ocean, restored Virginia and the Barbados Islands to England that had fallen during that time to the Spanish. In the summer of 1654, the Lord Protector summoned the Spanish ambassador, and he told him, Englishmen in Spanish territories should have the liberty to worship as they pleased. Free of the Inquisition, an English trader should no longer be molested by Spain. The negative response of the ambassador prompted Cromwell to send an English fleet to San Domingo and to Jamaica. The expedition to Jamaica succeeded in conquering this previous Spanish territory, and most people would have forgotten that. They think that Jamaica's always been British, but in fact, they'd be speaking Spanish here today if it hadn't been for Cromwell. Cromwell dreamed that Calvinists from New England would settle on Jamaica, but unfortunately, future kings turned it into another Barbados where the English shipped the criminals and rebels. One reason why England was such a law-abiding society is any criminal got transportation off to Australia or Jamaica or Barbados. And that way, the police could walk around without weapons and nobody needed to lock anything because the criminal class was exported, as they called it, transportation. One of the most important achievements was defeating the Barbary pirates. In April 1655, Admiral Blake led the English Navy into the pirate stronghold of Tunis, what today is Tunisia, in North Africa, destroying the bay's ships and forcing the Sultan to release all English prisoners and slaves. This is one of the very first European victories against the Barbary pirates of North Africa, and most important. Oliver Cromwell sent his warm congratulations on this decisive act against the Barbary pirates and ordered Blake to proceed to Cadiz to intercept Spanish ships carrying treasure from the New World. Pirates first, Catholic second. And he's most appreciated for having defended the Waldensians. In May 1655, the Catholic Duke of Savoy unleashed a vicious persecution against the Protestant Huguenots in Vaudois, or the Waldensian Valley. Newspapers in England reported a devilish crew of priests and Jesuits leading unspeakable atrocities against their Protestant brethren. Oliver Cromwell immediately sent an agent to the scene whose reports verified this persecution, and the Lord Protector headed a subscription list that raised several hundred thousand pounds for the relief of the Waldensian victims. Now, several hundred thousand pounds in those days would be tens of millions of pounds today. Probably be in hundreds of millions of pounds today. Just extraordinary. And here you can see his secretary, John Milton, one of the most famous English writers of prose, who wrote books like Paradise Lost, Paradise Regained. Cromwell then brought pressure to bear upon the Duke to stop the campaign, and the threat of mobilising the English Navy and the new model army quickly sobered the Duke of Savoy, and the Waldensians survive to this day. His letter's just brilliant. So, iron fist and velvet glove. We'd so much like to live in peace with you. We would hate to have to send the English Navy to burn your ships and new model army to destroy your army. We would like to have trade with you. So if you will just allow the Waldensians to live, which is a decent Christian thing to do, then we can be at peace. And peace was declared very, very quickly. Cromwell is known for social justice. He turned his attention to cruelty to animals. He banned cockfights and bear baits, which was unfortunately common at that stage, a leftover from the Middle Ages. That got outlawed. Vagrants who often were involved in drunkenness and theft were swept up by the military, evaluated by officers, and either imprisoned or sent to forced labour outside the country. So quickly, there weren't any vagrants on the streets very soon. He also made a surprising stand for freedom for the Jews. It may be recalled that King Richard the Lionheart had expelled all Jews from England. Cromwell invited them all to return to England. Jews had been officially expelled from England in 1290. The Puritan protector now launched a campaign for their return. He didn't theologically approve of them, or Unitarians, or any group that denied the deity of Christ, of course. But Cromwell favoured freedom of religion, and he wanted to see the fulfilment of the prophecy of Jews being brought to repentance and salvation in Christ, as the book of Romans tells us. Cromwell hosted Manasseh ben Israel at the Whitehall, and this earned Cromwell a lot of opposition, especially from London merchants who foresaw some fearsome competition from this close-knit network. On the 4th of December 1655, Cromwell made a speech which smothered the objections of the council to the readmittance of Jews to England. And Cromwell, of course, had to survive a lot of conspiracies and threats. If you've ever read any of the books on the Musketeers, the Three Musketeers and the Four Musketeers, of course, they're on the other side. They're fighting the Huguenots and they're doing conspiracies against Cromwell's England. But you would see a lot of these secret intrigues that went on at that time. And Cromwell was the target of many Catholic attempts, including by Musketeers, to have him assassinated. He was burdened by the cost of war against Spain, and his head of security, Thillot, uncovered numerous plots to murder the protector. He needed a top-class security system, and maybe he had thought in how useful the Jews could be, because the Jewish merchants who returned to England and flourished proved most useful to England's survival by providing vital intelligence. Of course, they were well-networked through Spain, and they knew what was going on in France and Spain because they were the merchants and the bankers. And so often, they were able to slip information about this assassination attempt or another. And interesting that his intelligence service benefited from the goodwill that they got from the Jewish merchants in allowing them to come back to England. Maybe there was rhyme in his reason. Cromwell's also famous for refusing the crown of England. There were several offers of the crown that they said England must have a king and you should be a king and start a new lineage. You know, to hell with the Stuarts, let's have Cromwell's dynasty, and he refused. He said, I cannot undertake this government with the title of king. The whole of Europe was astonished. Because how many people would refuse an offer like that? But Calvinists hailed the decision as proof that Cromwell didn't bow down to the honours of this world. He was not doing this for power or prestige. And he turned England into a refuge for the persecuted. Not only did the protector welcome Jews to England, but Protestants of all nations. The University of Oxford received an influx of distinguished foreign Protestant professors. Education profited immensely from the Commonwealth and from the Calvinists. And at sea, victory against Spain. In 1658, 6,000 English soldiers defeated the Spanish in Mardyk, Gravelines, and Dunkirk, just across the coast in the Channel. This finally secured the freedom of Protestant Holland from what had previously been the Spanish Netherlands, which is of immense interest to us in Cape Town, because if that wasn't possible, then Holland wouldn't have been able to come over to the Cape and, of course, settle the Cape. It was finally freeing them from the Spanish that made possible so much of the establishment of Protestant faith here in the southernmost tip of Africa. Also a surprise is how he restored the House of Lords. Of course, Parliament had abolished the House of Lords, but Cromwell restored it. He said, unless you have such a thing as balance, we cannot be safe. You cannot trust a single House of Parliament. You've got to have two Houses of Parliament. You've got to have the more traditional, protecting against the ones who want change. And there was also limits of tolerance. One of the most famous events that took place in church history during this time was the Westminster Assembly, which produced the Westminster Confession of Faith and the Westminster Catechisms, all of which you've got in the hallway available in reprints. Cromwell's religious toleration even led to him having talks with George Fox of the Quakers. When a well-known Quaker preacher, James Naylor, rode in triumph into Bristol on a donkey to the cries of Hosanna from his hysterical supporters, who changed Naylor's name to Jesus, the parliamentary authorities arrested Naylor for blasphemy and sentenced him to a whipping, branding, and life imprisonment. Cromwell was appalled and he sought to alleviate the sentence, but he was informed that he could not. He didn't have the power to prevent this overreaction to this obviously deluded individual. Oliver Cromwell has frequently been blamed for many of the excesses of the Commonwealth Parliament. However, much of these extremes, like the banning of Christmas and the closing of theatres, was done by the Presbyterian Parliament and rescinded by the Puritan Protector when he got control. What of great importance to him was the Protestant Alliance. Oliver Cromwell sought to build up a Protestant league throughout Northern Europe. He settled disputes between Denmark and Sweden, who had been fighting. He concluded alliance with Sweden. He restored the supremacy of the seas to England. He even challenged the Catholic powers and the Muslim pirates in the Mediterranean. And his Protestant League was unassailable. Nobody wanted war with the new model army and with a united Protestant world. And so this brought an end to the 30 Years' War, and there was no more conflicts between the Catholics and the Protestants from this point. Not in Europe, there wasn't. Northern Ireland, something else. During the times of Oliver Cromwell, England was feared and respected throughout Europe. Cromwell formed a strong alliance between Holland and England. He negotiated peace between Protestant nations. He cleared the English Channel and the Mediterranean Sea of pirates. And he expanded foreign trade. And he worked enthusiastically for the evangelism of the Indians in North America, the first pagans to fall under English control. And during the time of Oliver Cromwell's protectorate, the whole world learned to respect British sea power. Cromwell became known as the champion of Protestantism, an arbiter of Europe, a patron of learning and of the arts, and a tireless worker to lay legal foundations and checks and balances for the parliamentary rule of England, and hence his statue in the parliamentary wall in Geneva. Well, it looks like some people have taken shots at it. It's got a few bullet holes all around, but nevertheless. He's on the wall, one of only 10 statues of historical figures associated with the Reformation, and he's not even 16th century. He's 17th century. That's quite extraordinary that they would honour a man several generations removed from the Reformation. His title was Protector. While some have sought to describe Oliver Cromwell as a dictator, there was no attempt to make any kind of party around the personality of the Protector. Respect was always shown for private property in England. There was an effective and vocal opposition, and it was always tolerated under his rule. Very few people were put to death under the Protector, and none for purely political crimes. No one was cast into prison without trial. He was not a dictator, not like Charles. It was a heritage of freedom. Liberty of conscience, freedom of the press flourished under Oliver Cromwell. Religious toleration reached new heights, unprecedented up to that time. It's remarkable that in the bitter time of conflict, Oliver Cromwell could write, "We look for no compulsion but that of light and reason." He pioneered the new model army. He created the world's first global sea power. He laid the basis for both the Industrial Revolution and the British Empire. He preserved the common law. Otto Scott in The Great Christian Revolution wrote, "Luther and John Knox and Calvin and Cromwell lifted millions from the swamps in which they were placed by elegant men in power." He noted that the foundational work of Oliver Cromwell in establishing checks and balances for the rule of law triumphed in the United States. As people inspired by his example instituted many of the same principles of government and restrictions on power in America that Cromwell had worked so hard to achieve in England. Yes, Cromwell didn't achieve everything he wanted to in England. But a few generations later, the Americans implemented the very principles that he had pioneered and that he had experimented with at the end of the English Civil War. Otto Scott writes, "Our War of Independence raised men like Cromwell's who fought like Cromwell's for the same reason that Cromwell fought. The men at Philadelphia, which is where the American Constitution Bill of Rights was set up, echoed the history of the 1640s and 1650s when they wrote the Constitution with its limitations on the powers of Congress. The presidency and the court, when they said in the Constitution that this nation would not have an established church, they reflected the experience of their forebears with Archbishop Laud and his successors." So, plainly, you can see, in fact, in the unique way that the United States of America is set up, the hand of Cromwell and the experience of the English Civil War and the lessons they learned there and the things that didn't work, like having a single chamber of parliament, it didn't work. All the things that Cromwell wrestled with was implemented later in America, and the American form of government would be unthinkable without the experiments of the English Civil War. When the American founding fathers spoke about open doors to all, open careers to all, they spoke in accents of Cromwell and the Calvinists, the Independents and the Congregationalists and the Puritans and the Presbyterians and the Levelers and all those who fought under those banners. All this and more came from the great Christian Revolution, the English Civil War. All the liberties that men know have come from Christianity, from its lessons about the individual and the state, God and his covenant, to fulfill God's word by bringing justice, truth, faith, and joy to the world. You see, scripture alone led to constitutionalism. The very name Congress comes from the word congregation. What many people aren't aware of, and why we have a oil painting of Oliver Cromwell in our hallway just as you entered into this boardroom, is because Oliver Cromwell was not just a soldier and a statesman, but he was someone with a world missionary vision. Under Cromwell, the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in New England was established, and an enormous sum of money was donated towards this first evangelical missionary society. Cromwell was keenly interested in the evangelization of the Red Indians, and he proposed a comprehensive plan for world evangelism, dividing the world up into four great mission fields. Unfortunately, the death of Oliver Cromwell and the restoration of the monarch in England under Charles II set back the cause of missions by centuries. He was a man ahead of his time. One of the books on him is entitled Chief of Men, and John Milton wrote, "Cromwell, our chief of men, who through a cloud not of war only, but detractions ruled, guided by faith and matchless fortitude, to peace and truth the glorious way has ploughed, and on the neck of crowned fortune proud, has reared God's trophies and his work pursued. While Darwin's stream with blood of Scots imbued, and Dunbar field resounds thy praise loud, and Vista's laurel wreath, yet much remains to conquer still. Peace hath her victories, no less renowned than wars. New foes arise, threatening to bind our souls with secular chains. Help us to save the conscience from the paw of hireling wolves, whose gospel is their gnaw." That's some of Milton's The Chief of Men. He's been described by President Teddy Roosevelt as one of the greatest English leaders of all time. Teddy Roosevelt wrote a book on Oliver Cromwell, which I've got, in the year 1900, and he described him as the greatest Englishman of the 17th century, the greatest soldier statesman of the 17th century, whose sacrifices and achievements have produced the English-speaking world as we at present know it. And that's probably true. The Parliament of England being the mother of all parliaments, the gold standard of all representative governments, would not be so if it hadn't been for his work. Theodore Roosevelt makes comparisons with the Confederate General Stonewall Jackson and Oliver Cromwell, and the American War of Independence with the English Civil War. Theodore Roosevelt concluded that, in his opinion, Oliver Cromwell was one of the greatest of all Englishmen, and by far the greatest ruler of England itself. A controversial opinion, but a man who, in times that tried men's souls, dealt with vast problems and solved tremendous problems. A man who erred, but who strove mightily towards the light as it was given him to see the light. A man who had the welfare of his countrymen and the greatness of his country very close to his heart, and who sought to make the great laws of righteous living forces in the government of the world.